Lone Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. America's politics have been on TV all week, from the Supreme Court confirmation hearings to a pair of presidential town halls on at the same exact time. Now it's time for us to talk about them on the radio. It's State of Affairs, our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State, plus a fun but COVID-compliant list of things to do this weekend. That and a lot more is all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Thanks for joining us this Friday. Coming up, the Sheriff's Civilian Oversight Committee has called for Alex Villanueva to resign, but what happens next? We'll dig into that just ahead. But first, to State of Affairs. That's our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. California election officials are still battling the state GOP over those unauthorized ballot boxes that have popped up all over the state. Plus, Senator Dianne Feinstein just can't win, especially after a hug witnessed around the world. Joining us for State of Affairs is KPCC senior political reporter Libby Denkman and Jack Pitney, the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Now, Libby, let's start with you. You've been tracking the story of the ballot drop boxes marked official that are anything but official. Many were set up by the state Republican Party. There was a deadline to remove them by 5 p.m. last night. What's the latest?
Well, it depends on who you believe what the latest is. We had a press conference this morning that reporters were tuned into from Attorney General Javier Becerra and Secretary of State Alex Padilla, in which they said, basically, you know, nothing to see here. The Republican Party had admitted wrongdoing and that they had removed these ballot boxes that were placed outside of churches, even gun stores, in districts mostly that had competitive congressional races. So areas of LA County, Orange County, and Fresno County, also parts of Ventura. Well, just shortly after that, the Republican Party said, nope, we're still operating these drop boxes. We have removed any signs that say they are official, and we are moving them indoors so that we will have personnel observing them and kind of monitoring, making sure that they're secure. But we're still operating the drop boxes. And under the analysis that Secretary Padilla has shared about election code, any drop box that's operated by a third party that's not the county elections office in which a voter resides, that drop box is not legal. So we are in this funny gray area where both the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, and the Republican Party are really talking past each other, and it's not clear what is next.
So I just want to be completely clear on this. California's top leaders told the Republican Party in California to stop doing this, and they said no.
Yeah, the Republican Party responded to the cease and desist with a defiant, we're going to keep collecting ballots in these boxes. However, the Attorney General and the Secretary of State today said the rhetoric on social media and the rhetoric in the press is not evidence of ballot box collection. And they argued that their investigation showed that the Republicans had stopped this. However, we see, for example, State Senator Melissa Melendez tweeting even during the press conference that Padilla and Becerra were holding this morning, tweeting, yes, we are continuing to use drop boxes and they are secure. So it honestly feels like so much of our political landscape is today that we have one set of facts and another set of facts, and people are living in alternate realities. And honestly, the reporters are left to say, hey, you know, what is actually happening here? Because you're both saying exactly the opposite thing.
So those good old alternative facts. Jack Pitney, California is already a very Democratic state, but there are some closely watched congressional races here that could go either way. And we're going to get into that a little bit more later in the show. But I wonder what impact, Jack, if any, this clash over ballot boxes might have over those who may still be undecided. Essentially, who comes out looking good here?
Nobody really looks great, but to anybody who's paying attention, it may look as if the Republicans tried to pull a fast one, particularly with those labels that said, quote unquote, official. Now, if they had dispensed with those labels to begin with, if they had the boxes attended as they said they were going to, a lot of the trouble could have been avoided. But right now, it's going to strike a lot of people as a typical partisan kerfuffle.
Yeah, that's all they need to do, right, Jack, is just to have someone there, because that's what the rules say. Someone has to be there to sign for the ballots, and then there really wouldn't be an issue.
That's right. The key thing, if you look on your ballot envelope, or at least the ballot envelope I got, the person who brings the ballot in has to sign for it. And that's one of the holdups here.
Libby, how likely is it that this ballot box issue will lead to charges or maybe end up in court?
Well, the Secretary of State and the Attorney General said today they are not pursuing legal charges because, again, they argued that the Republicans had stopped using the ballot boxes. I do want to note that Republicans are pushing back on that idea that there must be someone to sign the ballot. Well, there is a field, as Jack said, on your return envelope in LA and in Orange County and a lot of counties for a third party to indicate, I'm taking over this ballot and I will return it to elections officials within 72 hours. The Republican Party in California is arguing there is no law actually compelling that third party to fill out that field. And so they are defending collecting things in an unofficial ballot box and not signing the envelope as legal under the law. So if this continues, I mean, there's a chance it could end up in court, but it doesn't feel like state officials want to have that fight on their hands.
Well, Jack, good news is that despite the ballot box story, people are breaking records about early voting here in Southern California and also actually around the country. So what do we know so far about what this means for the outcome of the presidential race?
Advantage Democrats. As of this morning, there were more than 22 million voters who'd cast ballots nationwide, about 2.4 million of them here in California, and over a million in Los Angeles County alone. Now, among the states that have party registration, and not all of them do, the early vote by registered Democrats is about 2-to-1 greater than the early vote by cast by Republicans. Now, there are two cautions here. One, party registration doesn't necessarily tell you how a person's going to vote, and the trend lines could change as we get closer to Election Day. But given the numbers that we see as of today, I'd much rather be in the Democratic camp than the Republican camp.
All right. Now, yesterday, both President Trump and challenger Joe Biden had competing town halls on at the same exact time, different networks. They were going to have a debate, but that didn't happen. So let's listen to some of the highlights from both.
When a president doesn't wear a mask, then, you know, people say, well, it mustn't be that important.
No, because I was okay with the masks. I was good with it. But I've heard many different stories on masks.
If young black women and men vote, you can determine the outcome of this election. Not a joke.
I have done more for the African-American community than any president, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln.
This president embraces all the thugs in the world. He doesn't take on Putin in any way.
I don't owe Russia money. I don't know. I owe a very, very small. It's called mortgages.
Just this week, you retweeted to your 87 million followers a conspiracy theory that Joe Biden orchestrated to have SEAL Team 6, the Navy SEAL Team 6, killed to cover up the fake death of bin Laden.
That was a retweet. I'll put it out there. People can decide for themselves.
I don't take a position. You're not like someone's crazy uncle who can just retweet whatever.
And that's Savannah Guthrie, by the way, on NBC, engaging with the president there. Those are just snippets. Overall, though, Jack Pitney, what did you take away from these two competing events? And has this forever changed the debate format eventually, if this is how it's going to go?
Well, the events last night showed us how unusual Donald Trump is. A president, a presidential candidate appearing in a national television event usually prepares. But Trump is averse to preparing. He likes to wing it. And we saw the president winging it last night. And as usual, some of his statements were not exactly in line with the factual record. Now, it's unlikely for the future that fellow Republicans are going to follow his lead in that respect. If you look at the next generation of folks who are coming up, people like Nikki Haley or Tom Cotton, they would be absolutely prepared. They'd be ready with their sound bites. They'd have all their facts and figures straight. And that was sort of what we saw with Joe Biden. Obviously, he is of a certain age. He's lost a step or two. But still, taking that into account, he was prepared as a regular presidential candidate would be. So the kind of things we saw with President Trump are kind of a one-off.
We're talking State of Affairs with KPCC senior political reporter Libby Denkman and Jack Pitney, the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Now, Libby, as I alluded to earlier, there are some competitive congressional races in Southern California districts that were once red but are now purple. You've been tracking District 25, which covers most of the northern parts of L.A. County. That seat was vacated by Democrat Katie Hill, who resigned. There's since been a special election to fill it temporarily. It is now up for grabs again. What's the latest on District 25?
Yeah, interestingly, that special election May 12th between Christy Smith, the Democratic Assemblywoman, and Mike Garcia, who was then a Republican candidate and is now a member of Congress, that was probably the first COVID-era election for California because, the lockdown restrictions had been in place, folks had to wear masks to go to vote, and that there were ballots sent out to everyone in that 25th district. So looking ahead at this race again, Mike Garcia was able to beat Christy Smith by close to double digits in the special election. Now, a lot of folks will say that Republicans are just better at turning out in those kind of offbeat, off-time elections. Christy Smith was not as strong of a fundraiser as her predecessor in the seat, Katie Hill. But, you know, Christy is going to be buoyed by strong Democratic turnout in California and in the 25th district specifically. Garcia, for his part, during the special, was very closely aligned with Donald Trump, would talk about the president quite a bit, would reference him, even stood next to a cardboard cutout of him during a lot of interviews. But lately, he hasn't been as closely embracing the president. And I think you see that in House and Senate races nationwide, that it's not seen as much of a boon to align yourself with this president when polling numbers are showing he is struggling in a lot of key areas.
Libby, I know you've done a lot of engagement with voters over the last few months. So what are the major issues that factor into their vote this fall in that district?
Healthcare is a huge one. That's something that Democrats in 2018 just hammered home, the threat to the Affordable Care Act when they won the blue wave elections across the country. COVID response is a big one. Wildfires in the 25th district, that is an area, Santa Clarita and the Antelope Valley, that have been repeatedly threatened by wildfires. And you'll hear Christy Smith talking again and again about climate change and its effect to exacerbate the fires. Mike Garcia talks much more about forest management. Garcia also dings Christy Smith quite a bit on AB5, the gig economy worker restrictions that were passed in Sacramento or are on the ballot again in a proposition for the November ballot. AB5 is not on, has anything to do with a member of Congress, but because Christy Smith voted for it in the assembly, Garcia really hits that as a job killer. So a number of local issues, but also, of course, national issues touching this race.
Jack, from Northern LA County to Orange County, a couple of tight races there, one that had flipped from red to blue back in 2018, the county as a whole. What would Republicans have to do to turn those districts like those back solidly in the red camp, or is that genie just out of the bottle now?
Well, the Republicans already did the most important thing by running the strongest possible candidates. 48th District, Harley Ruda, Republican candidates, Michelle Steele, elected official, Asian American, mainstream Republican, well qualified. Pretty much the similar thing in the 39th District, incumbent Gil Cisneros, the Republican candidate, Young Kim. Again, well qualified Asian American woman with elected experience. In a normal year, they might actually be favorites to flip these seats, but as Libby just pointed out, there is the very strong chance of a blue wave, and it's difficult for even the strongest candidates to overcome a big national wave.
All right, let's wrap up State of Affairs with the Supreme Court hearings for nominee Amy Coney Barrett. Senate Judiciary Committee has scheduled October 22nd for its vote on her, after which it heads to the full Senate for the final confirmation. Jack Pitney, these hearings were definitely contentious. How did she hold up under the spotlight? And did we actually get a clear sense of how she would perform on the court?
She was a superb witness. She was well prepared. She demonstrated a thorough understanding of the law. She was cool.
And didn't need any notes. She didn't need any notes. That's a notepad moment. Yeah.
Now, the thing was, as a result of her being really well prepared, we didn't really get a great sense of how she would vote, because one of the goals of any witness in this kind of situation is to avoid making commitments that could give people an opportunity to come out against her. So she didn't really reveal what, how she would vote if Roe v. Wade were the issue. She wouldn't commit that to taking a position on whether the president could pardon himself. But this is not unusual for Supreme Court nominees. The Supreme Court nominees who've been confirmed have all done the same thing, not committing to how they would vote on the court.
It kind of feels, Jack, like a run out the clock situation. I hate to simplify it, but that's what it feels like.
That's right, because she had the advantage. If nothing changes, she is going to be confirmed on the court, and she just wanted to hold things in place.
Libby, what's your sense of how much voters here in Southern California are watching this confirmation process play out, and whether it's maybe swaying them one way or another? I mean, is the court an issue that they're voting on, you think?
Well, I mean, you know the phrase hate watching, right? I mean, something that liberals are doing.
The Dodgers. I do it with the Dodgers all the time.
Yeah, liberals in Southern California are certainly hate watching these hearings. But honestly, there wasn't a ton of slack left in the system for them to get more fired up about this election. I mean, they're pretty energized already about President Trump. Of course, losing Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a huge blow, especially to the left. But, as much as they voters here are fearing the effects on, say, Roe v. Wade, effects on the Affordable Care Act, I think that because in California, we're pretty sure that, you know, California state elected officials, for example, would find a way to protect a woman's right to choose. The issue specifically about Amy Coney Barrett, I think, is just part of a larger narrative that liberals are weaving about the way that Republicans supposedly stole this seat with the whole Merrick Garland episode. So, yeah. They care, but it's not as though they could have gotten much more fired up. Anyway, they're watching, and it's just kind of more fuel for the fire.
You know, at the close of the hearings yesterday, Dianne Feinstein hugged Lindsey Graham and thanked him for a job well done, said, quote, "This is one of the best set of hearings that I have participated in." Libby, that hug did not go over very well with some liberal groups. So what's been some of that reaction?
Oh, sure. I mean, I just have in my inbox right now in the last few minutes got a release from NARAL Pro-Choice America, the, very strong pro-choice group that is influential in politics. Elise Hoag, the president of that group, saying that she wants Feinstein to step down as ranking member on the Senate Judiciary. Liberals across the spectrum are saying, maybe it's time for her to step aside, that this was really disappointing to see that she didn't seem to have that fire in her belly to, challenge Graham and challenge the proceedings. Interesting, though. I mean, I love to hear Jack weigh in on this. Feinstein was elected in the year of the woman in 1992. She is an octogenarian now, but she used to be a symbol of sort of women coming to prominence and really joining the Senate and going into leadership positions. 2018 is also compared to the year of the woman for, elected officials like Katie Porter and AOC coming into Congress. And it feels as though this reaction from liberals is sort of a part of a long passing of the torch that Feinstein is kind of being forced to be part of.
Jack, really quick, what did you make of all that?
Politically, it was an unforced error. All she had to do was say, "Thank you, Mr. Chairman." That's it. but the extra gesture of the hug and the greatest hearing, that didn't help her any, and it just gave Democrats heartburn. So that was a huge mistake for her.
That's Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College, also KPCC Senior Political Reporter Libby Denkman. Jack, Libby, have a great weekend.
Thanks, A.
Thank you.
More Take Two coming up. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. 4 years ago, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors created the Sheriff's Civilian Oversight Commission to watchdog the long-troubled Sheriff's Department. Well, yesterday, the panel called on Sheriff Alex Villanueva to resign, saying he had failed to address serious problems at the agency, such as deputy gangs, and had blocked the commission's efforts to oversee the department. The panel's vote is advisory only, but comes amid eroding public support for the sheriff. So the question is now, well, now what? Here to help us sort all of that out, we have Priscilla Ochen. She's a member of the commission and a criminal law professor at Loyola Law School. We also have with us KPCC's public safety reporter, Frank Stoltz. Professor Ochen, this news, not surprising, but still stunning. Briefly, can you recap how we even got to this point?
In my view, it's been a long time coming. So, as you said, the commission was established about 4 years ago, halfway into our existence. We had a change of administration from Sheriff Jim McDonnell to Sheriff Alex Villanueva. And we were very hopeful that the new sheriff would embrace the reforms that he described as part of his platform to restore, rebuild, and reform the Sheriff's Department. He articulated views that were very progressive regarding reforms like bail, population reductions, immigration. And so we were very excited to work with him when he took office in 2018.
Did you ever ask him outright how he felt about the commission and any recommendations they would make in the future?
We as a commission tried to, we stayed out of the race. We are a nonpartisan entity, and contrary to, some of the claims that the sheriff has made, we are an independent agency, independent from the Board of Supervisors, independent from the OIG, and independent from the Sheriff's Department. So we never, although I observed the debates and attended one, I personally did not have an opportunity to talk with Mr. Villanueva prior to his election. I did read some of the statements he made about civilian oversight, which were troubling to me, but they were somewhat ambivalent toward civilian oversight. But we hope that we could build some bridges once he got to know about the commission, what our goals were, and that they were aligned. But that simply didn't happen. From the beginning of the sheriff's tenure, he flouted rules regarding deputy discipline, attempting to reappoint a deputy who had been fired for cause for allegedly.
Is Villanueva's behavior, though, Professor, different than McDonald's behavior on this?
I think so. The sheriff, Sheriff Villanueva, when he took office, he immediately began to undo many of the important reforms that were established under Sheriff Jim McDonnell. One is the disclosure of the Brady list to the district attorney's office. He was very resistant to doing so. He deactivated a number of, dozens of pending disciplinary proceedings that would have resulted in penalties up to and including termination of deputies accused of misconduct, rising to the level of child abuse or falsification of evidence, lying. The kind of people that, we worry about harming the institution and harming members of the public. Okay. And it got worse from there. Demoted constitutional advisors, terminated, staff at the at the Sheriff's Department without notice.
And Professor, we did reach out to the Sheriff's Department to have him join us today. He has we have not heard back from him. Frank, so let me bring you in, Frank. What has he had to say about all this?
Well, first of all, I want to say that each and everything that the professor mentions, it should be noted, is in line with the deputies union, the Association for LA County Sheriff's Deputies. And they spent upwards of $1.5 million getting Sheriff Villanueva elected. I cannot point to one change he's made or one policy he's enacted that is not in line with their wishes. Make that what you want to make of it. The department issued a statement that called the vote meritless, politically motivated. I should say earlier this week, as he has in the past, The sheriff accused the civilian commission of waging a proxy war on him on behalf of the Board of Supervisors, which appoints the commission. You know, Villanueva, as you know, A, has long been at odds with the board over his rehiring of Carl Mandoyan. That's his political aide who was fired from the department over domestic violence allegations and lying. And he's battled with the board over his budget deficit. He merely says the board should just write him a bigger check, sort of an unprecedented position for a sheriff. And A, Villanueva often sees his opponents as anti-law enforcement, and he's accused the board of that. And this week he accused the civilian commission of that. Here's Sheriff Villanueva.
They really, really hate cops, or they slightly hate cops, or they're not too sure. And that doesn't really represent the breadth of people's opinions on law enforcement in L.A. County.
And A, yeah. It doesn't really meet the smell test. You know, we should point out that the commission has some very pro-cop people on it. Robert Bonner is a former federal judge, a Republican who once ran the Drug Enforcement Administration under President Bush, the first President Bush. Lael Rubin is a career prosecutor who was a high-ranking deputy to former Republican District Attorney Steve Cooley. And another member, J.P. Harris, is a former sheriff's lieutenant. And one other thing I'd like to point out in the sheriff's department's statement, you know, it says Villanueva has lawfully responded to all subpoenas from the civilian panel. And yet he defied a subpoena earlier this year because he doesn't even believe the voter approved Measure R, overwhelmingly approved in March, which gives the commission subpoena power, right, is legal. So he defies it.
Professor Ochin, there was some concern expressed by some of your colleagues on the commission that this move against the sheriff might hamper the group's ability to maintain effective oversight. So what do you think?
I think that's sort of like worrying about the quality of a relationship once you're already divorced. You know, the relationship has already been deeply severed as a result of the sheriff's unwillingness to come to the table to participate in our deliberations about meaningful policy reform. He threatened the office of the Inspector General, Max Huntsman, with a criminal prosecution for simply doing his job and attempting to monitor deputy disciplinary proceedings and the investigations into deputy-involved shootings. He accused the CEO of LA County of a felony, and has, you know, sort of closed the door on meetings with members of the commission. He rarely sent an undersheriff to any of our meetings when we have ad hoc meetings on committee meetings on issues as important as COVID. It took us issuing a subpoena before he would send someone to talk with us about this deadly disease that is threatening people who are in our facilities and has cost seven people their lives.
But Professor, the thing is, it's not quite a divorce. He is still in this job. The commission is still there. I realize that maybe it's on its way to a divorce possibly, but you still have to live with him.
Listen, we've invited the sheriff to each and every one of our public meetings. We have asked the sheriff for meetings to try to resolve some of these disputes after Commissioner Robert Bonner, who, as Mr. Stoltz said, as a former head of the DEA, former federal judge, called for the sheriff's resignation. Our chair and the vice chair reached out to the sheriff to try to smooth things over, to try to reset the relationship. He canceled the meeting. So the fact that the relationship has deteriorated to the point that it is not due to any lack of trying on the part of the commission, but instead is a lack of respect, a lack of regard for civilian oversight, a lack of respect for the voters and the wishes of the voters. Just can I finish this point? A lack of respect for the wishes of the voters and a lack of respect for reform efforts that are being undertaken in the county of Los Angeles, which the sheriff has simply absented himself from.
So if we all agree on that, then what actual power does the commission have to make something happen, to make the sheriff resign? Or what would the next steps be for the commission?
Listen, our job isn't to make the sheriff do anything. Unfortunately, we don't have that power. But what we do have is the power of the bully pulpit to continue to raise concerns so the public understands what's happening in our sheriff's department. I think had the commission existed some 15 years ago when the you know, corruption that was ultimately revealed in the Baca administration. Had we existed at that time, we could have stepped in earlier and called attention to the problems that were happening in the jails and in the department before it got to a crisis level. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to inform the public about the challenges with Sheriff Villanueva's leadership. We're trying to keep the board apprised, and we're trying to, frankly, get the sheriff's attention. Hopefully this is a wake-up call that will cause him to be more engaged with other members of the county who are concerned about the health and efficacy of the sheriff's department.
Frank, what might a recall process look like, considering the sheriff is an elected official, and how likely would that be?
It's a high bar. I think it's 450,000 signatures to even get a recall measure on the ballot. And then you not only have to get a majority to recall the sheriff, but also find another candidate to replace him. There has been talk of this among some. There's also been talk about possibly getting a measure that would change the LA County charter that would allow the Board of Supervisors to remove a sheriff. People are exploring the legality of that. I got to say one other thing about what the press just said. There was a real debate about whether or not to call for his resignation. It was a unanimous vote in the end. But, you know, there were people who raised your point, A, which was, you know, does this diminish the effectiveness of the commission? That's a real question going forward. The commission does have this subpoena power. It's going to court over some subpoenas that have been issued. So it will be a court battle in part to rein the sheriff in. But the independently elected sheriffs in California are extremely powerful people. It's very hard to exercise authority over them because of the way the Constitution is set up. And that brings up the last question, which is, should we appoint sheriffs by Board of Supervisors instead of elect them? That's an ongoing debate throughout the state. And I think Sheriff Villanueva is just the latest example of why maybe appointment is better than election.
KPCC's public safety reporter Frank Stoltz, and also Priscilla Ochen, member of the Civilian Oversight Commission and criminal law professor at Loyola Law School. Professor Frank, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
More Take Two coming up. Stay with us. Back now with More Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. Time now for the latest installment in our new series, Race in LA. Now, in it, we ask Angelenos how race and identity shape their day-to-day lives. The essays written by both community contributors and LAS staffers are published each week, and the hope is that these stories fuel meaningful, authentic conversations about our lived experiences as a certain race or ethnicity. This week's contributor is Juan Monet. He shares his essay about the differences between Miami and Los Angeles when it comes to race relations.
My friends and I have been drinking at a party all night. At some point, over the sound of the music, the conversation turns a familiar corner into the question of how race affects me in Los Angeles. I warn my friends, who are all native Angelenos, that I'm going to respond in Miamian. What I'm going to say to them will seem outlandish, but my intent isn't to confuse. It's to let them know that my view is informed by the place I was made and to describe the peculiarity of that place. It's to let them know that there's something else out there, a different planet almost, of bendable rules, where the perception of race works differently. As my friends can see, I have a tattoo on my index finger, 305, the area code for the place where I was born and raised. Someone at the party interrupts with a need to place me before I even begin, and I say, no, I'm not from the beach. To avoid slicing my city up and pinpointing my neighborhood, I do just the opposite and tie it all together. I'm from Miami, the whole thing. Miami isn't like LA, where you might need Spanish. People assume Miami and LA, big brown cities lined with palm trees and nightclubs, are the same. But of course they aren't. In Miami, our brown people come from the sea, our trees are shorter and thicker, our clubs more unruly. They aren't the same. In Miami, you have to know Spanish or you'll simply hit dead ends. Miami is where I went to school with Chinese kids that had Jamaican accents. It's where I had a white-skinned friend who was Argentinian and Cuban, but who was born in Mexico and raised in Miami. Someone at the party interrupts to ask if he's white passing, a question that begs this need to place him, despite what I've just said. He can't be placed. He's many things. I appease the inquirer. In LA, he would be passing. But my friend's question is nonsense to someone from Miami, where there's no true white for which to pass. In fact, the closest thing are those lost tourists, and there's no way we'd confuse the two. I know it sounds crazy, but there aren't really any white people to speak of back home. Take Mrs. Ruiz, my 11th grade English teacher. The first day of class, my quote-unquote white teacher, who had been in Miami long enough to know that she should and could voice her situation, explained that her Spanish wasn't good because she was actually from Trinidad and had gotten her last name through marriage to a Boricua. There was nothing weird about that. My front neighbor back then was a Boricua married to a Bahamian woman. Plus, the purportedly white Mrs. Ruiz, the islander, made us read Native Son and 100 Years of Solitude. So no chance Mrs. Ruiz was white. Maybe her ancestors had been, but that ship sailed a long time ago, all the way to Trinidad. So no, my white-skinned friend isn't white, and he isn't white-passing either. He's Argentinian, like his mom, but his dad is Cuban, and he was born in Mexico. He grew up in the 305. There's no simple answer over there, and we don't try to force one. The problem, their expressions tell me, is that it frustrates the rules of Los Angeles. My friends, spread out now between the table and the couch, are suspicious of such fluidity. Never in LA, they protest. That would never happen here. Can I blame an Angelino? I mean those born and raised here, forced to speak English in school, continuously disparaged, displaced, and erased by people who think that the geographical center of Los Angeles is Hollywood. By people who think downtown is the eastern limit of LA. This last idea makes my friends laugh almost as much as it angers them. If that's where LA ends, then where the hell did I grow up? I don't blame them for being incredulous. I figured they would be, because I've listened to their stories before. And I remind them that I'm not trying to downplay any of that. I just want to communicate that there's something else out there. They did ask me, after all. The thing is that my Angelino friends are just that, Angelinos. They were raised by LA, so they aren't used to habitually managing and adjusting the rules of racial perception. To them, a group of white people in Chinatown is just that. Nothing more, nothing less. It's just what it seems to be. Something too comfortably out of its place. They explain to me, with rehearsed rigidity, the same aerial dissection I've been hearing for years. This is Los Angeles. The West Side is white, South Central is black and brown, East LA is Mexican, and the Valley is kind of a mix, but it doesn't count anyway. And as a Miamian, I don't want to believe them, but I have to. They, too, have countless examples of how their city works. And I find myself nodding as I listen. I do agree that Culver City is, in fact, hella white. And that, on the other hand, there are no white people for days in Florence. And that El Mercadito might as well be Mexico. And that if I thought about it, I'd have to admit that I never go to the Valley. They go on and on, strengthening their case. The formula they're describing is something like a self-fulfilling prophecy that they didn't author and don't see the point in trying to rewrite, much less on a daily basis. So I get their point. LA is rigid and segregated. There are rules. What kind of an Angelino ever goes from Reseda to West Hollywood, then to Inglewood and Huntington Park or Boyle Heights? You go where your people are at, and that's that. And when it comes to choices, LA is a city of avoiding the other. I mean the expected discomfort of being near the other and seeking out your own kind, precisely for comfort. That's all part of the rules, and they know the drill.
That's LAS contributor Juan Moreno sharing parts of his essay, Who Invited Miami? An LA Transplant on the Rules of Racial Division and How We Can Bend Them. You can check it out at LAIST.com. That's LAIST.com. More Take 2 coming up in 60 seconds. Back now with More Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm E. Martinez. The city of Glendale has passed a resolution apologizing for its history as a sundown town, a term that refers to cities that once barred black people from being out on the streets after dark. The move makes Glendale the first city in California and just the third nationwide to apologize for its past of racial exclusion. Here's Glendale Public Information Officer Eliza Papazian.
By passing this resolution, the city apologizes for and condemns all racially motivated, discriminatory, or exclusionary aspects of the city's history and deeply regrets the pain and suffering such policies have caused.
She says city staff reviewed historical documents to identify and understand Glendale's history and racist past and are now in the process of putting together what she calls a historical context statement for the city.
Glendale City Council and staff will continue to engage in individual and collective work to understand bias and continue to examine the historical role that racism has played in Glendale.
And while there's no official record of sundown laws in the city, she says there is there's ample documentary evidence that Glendale was, in fact, a sundown town, including informal ways of excluding black people and other people of color from Glendale, such as intimidation and violence, as well as racially restrictive covenants in housing. For a deeper look into this history of Glendale, we turn to Gary Keyes, former history teacher at Crescenta Valley High School and retired social science professor at Glendale Community College. He's also the author of Wicked Crescenta Valley. Now, Gary, before we get into Glendale's past, let's start with the term sundown town. Where did the term come from and during what period was it enforced?
Well, starting approximately 1890, these towns began to crop up. Some of these cities were posted with very racist terminology to inform blacks that they were not allowed in the community. They were enforced sometimes by city statute and other times by informal procedures by the people of the community. At one time, there was estimated to be 10,000 sundown cities in America. I know Glendale and Burbank were in that category.
So how long did this go on for, Gary, and when did it actually come to an end?
Starting in 1890 to about 1930, things were at their worst. And it wasn't until what James W. Loewen, who wrote Sundown Towns, he felt that 1968 marked a turning point in which cities started to renounce this history.
So 1968 is a good spot to say that that's probably when this actually stopped.
Yes, it started to stop. Because
started to stop.
Went on until, to the turn of the century, to the 21st century, there were still towns trying to keep African-Americans out of their communities.
All right, now to Glendale, Gary, because the city passed a resolution last month and is currently in the process of putting together what the city's PIO has called a historical context statement for Glendale. Let's dive in, though, to the history a little bit. What can you tell us about Glendale's exclusionary past?
Well, in the 1920s, the KKK was very powerful in Glendale. They sponsored floats and parades down Brand Boulevard. There was a meeting of 15,000 Klansmen at Verdugo Park. They had an initiation ceremony at where Glendale College is today. In the 1930s, Glendale Community College battled Pasadena City College for a football championship. Jackie Robinson was playing for Pasadena at that time. He was assaulted after the game, badly enough to be hospitalized. In 1964, the American Nazi Party established its headquarters in Glendale. They came to Glendale because they said Glendale was a white man's town. They called their headquarters the White House. It was right across on Broadway, just across from the Galleria. The house is still there.
What do you make then, Gary, of this move by Glendale, and how should other cities consider following suit by acknowledging racist past and then maybe moving toward more anti-racism policies?
I applaud Glendale for its attitude, and it's long overdue, but it's certainly a hopeful sign for our times.
That's Gary Keyes, former history teacher at Crescenta Valley High School and retired social science professor at Glendale Community College. He's also the author of Wicked Crescenta Valley. Gary, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
All right, finally, we head into the weekend with some help for you on what to do.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, and A. Martinez, Halloween is coming up. However, going out to party or trick-or-treat is a bad idea in a pandemic. So just go to Smart and Final and buy a 24-pack of full bars for yourself. I swear, I actually do this all the time.
Oh, my gosh.
But what to do when you're digesting that sugar? We've got ideas.
That explains so much. All right.
Yeah,
so,
I do. Dark Kit Kats.
What's up first, Leo?
Well, you can buy some extras while you're getting candy for yourself. Now through Halloween in Pasadena is the Feed the Pumpkin Food Drive. You're really stuck on that.
Nice.
This benefit for the organization Friends Indeed is where they're collecting non-perishable food items that will be given to those hungry in Southern California, which is more important than ever this year. And if you go there today from 5 to 7, you can also pick up a free pumpkin decorating kit. And of course, going to do some good is free.
All right. What about more to do this weekend to support some good?
Yes, some good to do is helping out your local bookstore. Some are struggling right now, so remember to log off Amazon and buy local. Tomorrow, you can help out Village Well Books and Coffee, which is in Culver City. It's actually a pretty new bookstore, and it's hosting an author event and panel tomorrow. First will be Brian Sonia Wallace talking about his new book, The Poetry of Strangers. Then a panel, including Culver City's Poet Laureate, Janet Holt, talks about the city's literary and social history. That one's free as well, and RSVP, since these events are kind of a combo of being online and in person.
All right, perfect. Finally, one more thing to catch this weekend that also helps out local Angelenos, right?
Yeah, and this one helps out performance venues. So there's a theme here to help each other out.
Yeah.
And our small performance venues are no exception. Think about like the Troubadour or the Echoplex, which have been closed and are struggling to stay afloat. So today through Sunday, it's SOS Fest, SOS meaning Save Our Stages. It's hosted by comedian Reggie Watts, and you'll be able to catch recorded live performances from artists like Foo Fighters, Brittany Howard, Reba McEntire, Dave Matthews, and more. It's nothing upfront to watch, but make a donation for the Emergency Relief Fund set up by the National Independent Venue Association. Now, there are still a bunch more events to go to. You can find out what to do this weekend by heading to our site, LAIS.com. That's LAIST.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Leo Has a Cat.
All right, that's the always helpful Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2. We'll be back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.